This week on The Right Side, is Kenny's balanced budget feasible? The NDP calls it mean-spirited. A BC Liberal betrays his party to become Speaker. The federal government wants to change taxes impacting small businesses. And McKenna virtue signaling in the NAFTA negotiations. This is The Right Side, episode 33, recorded Saturday, September 9th, 2017. Mean-spirited or necessary? Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for The Right Side. This week, Patrick and myself are back, as we are each week here at The Right Side. Welcome back.
It's good to be back, and of course, if you haven't listened to us before, The Right Side is a podcast that aims to cut through all of the bias and sensationalism that you see in the media every single day, and even if you might not know it. And we've got a huge lineup of topics to talk about this week.
Indeed we do, ranging everywhere from Alberta, name-calling, BC Liberals, economic news from the tax front, and a firing line that, well, speaks for itself, but we'll get there in just a bit of time. This week, we're going to start with Alberta, and the headline this week, coming from the CBC, is Jason Kenney proposes drastic cut to Alberta per capita spending and balanced budget in 3 years. So this past Tuesday, during a Facebook Q&A session, Jason Kenney said his balanced budget plan can be accomplished in 3 years by focusing on operating spending and cutting per capita spending, which is the amount spent per person in the province. He wants to reduce it to a different level. A level that has been tested and a level that works in Canada. And he wants to reduce it to the same level as British Columbia.
Yeah.
Which is right where you guys are, province westward. In his Q&A session online, he said, "We would have to exercise a period of sustained restraint in spending in order to get us down more or less to British Columbia per capita spending over time. BC spends 20% less than Alberta per capita."
Further from it's proven that less amount actually contributes to having surpluses.
Yeah, as the BC Liberals left a surplus when they left, didn't they?
Indeed they did. It was about $2.3 billion, I believe.
That's a good amount. Further in the article, it goes on to state that according to the most recent figures from the Alberta Treasury Board and Finance, the Alberta government spends $12,517 on every man, woman, and child in the province, which is nearly $2,500 more per person than in British Columbia. The data is more or less confirmed by the Royal Bank's latest analysis of the fiscal status of the province, of the provinces, and the federal government here in Canada. So a third-party independent financial institute has in effect confirmed what the provinces have said, because this data was extrapolated by looking at what Alberta reported and what BC reported. And when the numbers are looked at by the RBC, they come to within a few hundred dollars each. So that is indeed the general ballpark that Alberta spends roughly $2,500 more per capita than the BC government does. Of course, Premier Rachel Notley responded, and she called this plan, quote, heartless, reckless, and mean-spirited. She continued saying that it would cause, quote, nothing but chaos. For sure, though, going forward, we need to engage in careful restraint. It's also worth noting that in the current forecast for the fiscal year, which was given last month in the Q1 fiscal update, the Alberta government has a budgetary deficit of $10.8 billion, with so far $15.8 billion accumulated in debt. This, of course, includes borrowing to fund the day-to-day operations of government. Debt servicing costs are forecast to be over $1 billion for the current fiscal year, $1 billion and $33 million to be precise. So with the current increases in interest rates, as we talked about on last week's episode of The Right Side, we can only expect this debt servicing cost to increase. So to call any plan to avert this reality of increased debt and increased debt servicing cost mean-spirited is pure political rhetoric that really deserves some honest discussion by both the government and the media involved in this case. When Premier Notley and the media spar over Jason Kenney's, quote, mean-spirited plan, the unemployment rate in Alberta has ticked up to 8.1% from 7.8% over the month prior, and this was aided by the unemployment rates in Calgary and Edmonton, which stand at 8.7% and 9.1% respectively. Despite positive indicators Canada-wide, as we talked about last week, Canada's economy growing at 4.5%, the economy and fiscal situation in Alberta still has much room to improve before we can say that we are truly out of the woods from the mess that was this past recession. So a mean-spirited plan called on by the premier here. And, you know, you'd think with that much in debt, the media would, you know, want to talk about the fact that we have, you know, similar population in Alberta and BC. But when it comes down to it, spending $2,500 more per person, and you ask Albertans if they feel they're getting services that are desired of that, you're going to get some mixed results across the board with that. So,
It's also fascinating that that she says it would cause nothing but chaos and instability, and the fact that I think there's that much debt that you have to pay on and all the interest that you have to pay on the debt, I would think that would be what's causing chaos and instability.
So, oh yeah, definitely.
That's some interesting rhetoric she's going with there.
I mean, you can look at interest rate hikes from debt servicing costs as one side of the coin, but along with that, the increased debt and the you know, structural deficits that are going on here, you end up in a situation where the province also takes credit rating downgrades. And, you know, even more so than the budgetary deficits and the, you know, what she says as, you know, the cuts, the drastic cuts that would come from this causing chaos and uncertainty, there is no more chaos and uncertainty towards the business and investment climate in Alberta than there is for the credit rating downgrades that Alberta will inevitably get, and we have got thus far. So it's certainly very interesting, the dual language coming out of this, both from the media and the government itself. When you think about it, bringing it down to BC level, that's kind of on par of what Western Canada is doing at this point in time. Anyways, I don't think there's anything else on that, so we can move on to BC if you're good for that.
Indeed. And there's lots of news out of BC this week. But first, I want to just do a follow-up on the ICBC story from just a few weeks ago. So on episode 30, I talked about how ICBC rates are going to be hiked up for everyone. And the report has just come out on that, saying that it's actually going to cost the average driver an extra $130 per year. So that's going to be nice to look forward to. Because BC already has some of the highest auto insurance rates in the country, and it's going to be hiked up even more. According to the report, quote, they are not going high enough to cover the true cost of paying claims. So clearly there's something going on there, and if there's anything more that comes out of that, I will surely mention it. But on to other BC news, where a BC Liberal actually surprisingly broke ranks and volunteered to become the Speaker of the House, despite the wishes of his party. Abbotsford South MLA Daryl Plakas has been acclaimed because no one else put their name forward. The loss of Plakas means that the Liberals only have 41 votes compared to the 44 that the NDP/Greens have. So it basically means that there won't be any successful attempt by the Liberals to call a vote of non-confidence on the NDP, who are being propped up by the Greens. The only way that they'd be able to do that is if they could somehow get the Greens on board with that.
The bathroom rule doesn't even apply anymore that you mentioned.
Yeah. So the BC Liberals say that Plakas had promised that he wouldn't make the move and that they are disappointed with the decision. Said interim leader Rich Coleman, quote, caucus had agreed and everyone had committed, including Mr. Plakas, to not run for speaker. So to change your mind and not inform me when you change your mind until after the fact, I still think that's a betrayal. As a matter of fact, on numerous occasions, he's reiterated to the caucus and to me that he had no intention whatsoever of running for speaker. I took him at his word. When you tell your colleagues that you're not going to do something, they take you at your word as well. You break your word, you go to do it, become the speaker, you've de facto already joined the NDP.
This is the most clear speaking I have seen after the BC election.
Yeah, this Rich Coleman is clearly much more direct with his words than Christy Clark was, I think. And it's very interesting because hours after the move, the BC Liberals kicked Darrell Plaikas out of the BC Liberal caucus. The party issued a statement saying, quote, constituents must be able to trust their elected representatives, it said. Party members must be able to trust those who hold positions of leadership in the party, and members of the legislature must be able to trust one another. The statement said that Plaikas' decision was a betrayal, one he made, quote, despite repeated promises and assurances that he would not. Now, of course, Plaikas threatened to quit the caucus earlier this year after demanding Christy Clark's resignation as party leader, and it's actually known that Plaikas is one of the chief reasons why she decided to resign. And by breaking with tradition, he's actually helping the New Democrats hold on to power. So all of this must make NDP Premier John Horgan smile with delight, as the news cycles are now occupied with this story rather than the story that the construction on the George Massey Bridge project has been cancelled and that that project is sent back to review, much like the NDP did with the Site C Dam project back in late August, which I also talked about. Now, the bridge was intended to replace the 58-year-old underground George Massey Tunnel that connects Delta with Richmond, and it's a key corridor from the ferry terminal to Vancouver, which faces daily overcrowding. So the cancellation, of course, brought derision from the Liberals, who said that the project has already been studied, debated, and analyzed for years now. There are more than 150 reports linked to the bridge on the project's website. Quote, I would hope they would speed up the process, said Delta South Liberal MLA Ian Payton. Quote, we were in the bridge replacement office this morning, and there had to be a dozen binders 5 inches thick of documents and studies and engineering reports on why the bridge is the best answer. They could simply send the bridge review committee to study the 14,000 pages that have already been worked upon and come to the conclusion that the bridge is the most sensible option. Of course, the province had shortlisted 3 companies to bid on the main contract, and 2 of those companies had submitted proposals already. The deadline for the government to pick a winner was October 24th. The 2 companies that will now be compensated up to $2 million each for their aborted bids, and taxpayers have already spent $66 million on engineering and geotechnical work, public consultation, land procurement, and site clearing, including preparations for the eventual widening of Highway 99. The speaker story also buries another issue surrounding the NDP government, which is namely the issue of the throne speech, which was also held on Friday.
Oh, that's big news. I didn't hear about the throne speech at all. It was 100% overshadowed by everything you've just been talking about.
Exactly. No one's heard about the throne speech, and yeah, I had to actually dig for it just to find what was actually talked about. And there was actually lots to talk about, which were namely the NDP promises on things like election finance reform, another electoral referendum, lobbying reform, childcare, housing, poverty, wages and education, healthcare and student debt. So while those are all important issues, what wasn't talked about were things like taxes, the economy, jobs and natural resources. So once again, we really see the priorities of this NDP government on display, and time will tell what they actually get done.
Yeah, and I mean, you could imagine that maybe perhaps, you know, the economic climate in BC is pretty good at this point, so maybe it was felt as though that a huge focus on taxes and the economy and spurring growth might not have been necessarily needing to be in the forefront, and they could just focus on some of the agenda and delivering for their base with this. But, you know, it's always good to have the economy in back of mind when talking about this. And I think that what was missing from the throne speech is an omission, and it's really unfortunate that it was buried by the turncoat Liberal speaker. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's something to note is that they really didn't talk much about the jobs or the economy or anything to do with that. And it was all basically based on social services. And while those are really important, we want to make sure that we have enough money to pay for those social services. Otherwise, we're in a situation like Alberta where we're paying a lot of extra interest on debt that's being accumulated. Now, BC has debt itself, and we are constantly paying that down as well. But the NDP plans mean that we'll be going into more debt, and there's not going to be much of a plan to repay that. So we're going to have to see what the actual numbers are and what's going to actually happen to the economy in BC, because right now we're doing very good, but that might not last, and we got to make sure that we're prepared for when it doesn't.
Yeah, we're going to have to see what investment climate looks like after the NDP tables their first budget, if there's any hidden tax measures in there or anything that could at all be remotely seen as hostile to business, because you know, there are two different kinds of hostile when it comes to monetary policy. There's outright hostile dealing with tax rates and whatnot, right? But then there mm-hmm. is kind of under the table hostile, where it might not be a tax rate increase, but it might be an increase in regulation or something that just slows down the business cycle. So we'll have to see if there's mm-hmm. anything like that in the budget that puts a cool on the economy or slows investor confidence. But
indeed.
Who knows? You think the speaker will preside for the length of this term, or?
Well, it really depends on if the Greens will keep propping up the NDP at this point, because right now the Liberals are at 41 and the NDP are at 41 and the Greens are at 3. So once again, they hold the balance of power, and the speaker's in for until they have an election, basically, at this point. And since he's going to be an independent, he's going to stay in as long as he can.
Right.
And I doubt he'll be able to be let back in again.
No.
So
that's a pretty big thing.
Mm-hmm. And the riding of Abbotsford South is very much a safe Liberal seat as well.
Oh yeah.
So I think that's, well, we're going to have to see. We're going to have to see if what will happen in by-elections that come up. There's the by-election in Christy Clark's old riding in Kelowna. And who knows what will happen? It's going to be interesting to watch.
All right, then. We're going to continue talking taxes, except this time we're going to take it up to Canada and focus on small business. And there was a piece this week in the Financial Post that should have got a little bit more attention than it did. It's by Jack Mintz, and it's called "Mere Tweaks Won't Fix the Liberals' Draconian Tax Reform Plan." So another one of the Liberals' campaign platforms in 2015 is slowly coming true. And during the campaign, it seemed as though the Liberals pledged to remove the small business deduction from the tax code. And what this effectively means is that a small business who employs 5 people would pay the same rate as a corporation that employs 5,000 or 50,000 people in Canada. And, you know, just before we begin here, this was in the tax section of the Liberal platform in 2015. So they did say they were going to do this. It seems like many people were shocked about this when it first hit the media. Is that the sense you got?
Yeah, a lot of people were shocked. And I think a lot of small business owners were definitely shocked about it too. But it was right there in their platform, and they did say they were going to do this. But the problem was is that the Liberals have been saying they're going to, you know, cut taxes on the middle class and raise them for the 1%. They've only been saying this for the past 2.5 years. But I think a lot of people think of themselves as middle class.
Right.
especially small business owners. So we all want to think that we're part of the middle class. But according to Liberals, there's only a small percentage of people that are actually going to be part of that tax cut bracket.
Right. I think it was somewhere 44,000 through 87,000. I might be wrong on that in terms of income, but
something like that.
That's a topic for another show.
Indeed.
After tax reductions right now, the corporate tax rate in Canada is 15%, and small businesses who receive this deduction ultimately pay a 10.5% tax rate. So that's 4.5 points lower than a standard corporation like Amazon or Walmart and whatnot. So this is, of course, who the Liberals are targeting, the small business owners here. And any business that brings in less than $500,000 in annual income is ultimately eligible for this deduction in terms of tax, and that is yearly deduction. Estimates from the Financial Post suggest that 70% of families in Canada receive dividends or funds they get paid by a small business and have a household income below $200,000. That means, of course, that the businesses affected by this will directly be affecting the middle class, contrary to what the Liberals say. According to a 2016 labor force survey from Statistics Canada, 70.5% of those people employed in Canada are employed by a small business with a business workforce of 1 to 99 people, while 19.8% of people in Canada are employed by a medium-sized business of 100 to 499 people. The Trudeau government has always said that it would be doctors, dentists, accountants, lawyers, and other professionals who bear the brunt of this change. And I think who they have effectively signaled out here is the white-collar workforce. Mm-hmm. But in reality, that is just going to account for a small 12% of all possible small business revenue here in Canada. There are other sectors that are equally as large, including manufacturing. You know, manufacturing, you know, little goods that might not be imported from China, imported in Canada in small plants like that. Construction mm-hmm. operators, which makes sense because most construction is done through public-private partnerships, and those private construction companies aren't going to be employing more than 500 people. And of course, high-tech innovators or entrepreneurs at 10%. So this is affecting, if you add that up, including the doctors and lawyers and dentists, that's 12% right there. Another 12% for construction workers, we're at 24%. And manufacturers, another 12%, that brings up to 36%. And when you factor in the tech innovators that the document talks about, we're up to 46%. Almost half of everyone employed in Canada is going to be affected by this who works for small mm-hmm. business. The Financial Post also provides some arguments as ways that this kind of neutrality that the Liberals are looking for could be achieved between unincorporated and incorporated businesses in Canada, but that's beyond the scope of our show here today. What they effectively want to do is create an equal playing field for the small businesses and the large businesses, but what it's coming across as is that they are looking at small businesses as a way of effectively hiding money from the tax man here. So what the National Financial Post document does is show a snapshot of how draconian these proposals would be. So here directly from the article, it says, under new rules, passive income can now be taxed at an almost confiscatory rate of over 70% as government claws back the benefits of the low corporate income tax rate on business income. The rules also result in heavier taxation on family succession compared to selling the company to unrelated domestic or foreign investors, resulting in a potential 90% estate tax on distributions of corporation shares to children. Now, when you think about that, a 90% estate tax on a business if you want to pass it on to your children. I don't know if that makes sense.
At that point, you might as well not even bother doing it.
Right. You might as well just shut down and sell it to a foreign investment company, which
– indeed.
You know, they claim to be they claim to be championing the middle class, as you said. But we just added it up right here, and the direct number of people who are going to be infected by this are 46% in terms of sectors. And it's going to be more than that based on the amount of people who actually work for small businesses. So with that being said – this is a direct attack on the middle class that they so want to try and protect. So, and you know, there's one more thing, and I think the reason why we're talking about this here on our show is that this really wasn't talked about much in the media in terms of the effect it's going to have, the magnitude of it. Sure, the media is talking about, you know, the opposition condemning it and businesses being upset about it, but they're not talking about the exact magnitude. 70% potential tax rate and almost a 90% estate tax if it's passed on to an immediate family member. So that's the numbers that are being left out, and just how wide small business employment is in Canada is what's being missed here by the media. And what's more, and something that could draw and should draw lots of attention here, is that this policy is aimed to be brought in one swift motion. It's not going to be a general overhaul to the tax code. They want to do it all in once, probably in this year's upcoming budget. And, you know, along with this, when you hear people talking about it, most are surprised by it, as we mentioned, but it was very clearly outlined in the 2015 campaign platform. And, you know, while the media is covering the issue here, the opposition is pointing this out, just the amount of ignoring that the media has done on the magnitude and the fact this is being done so quick, and what the costs are going to be to small businesses. That's the real story here that's being missed. And, you know, the Financial Post piece illustrates it quite well.
Yeah, just the large number of people that are going to be affected by these changes when they probably don't even realize they're going to be affected.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But even the people that aren't in small businesses, say they're self-employed or they're retired or they don't have a job, they're going to be affected by it too, because this is going to affect prices and it's going to affect what kind of businesses are going to be able to open up and be successful. And it's also going to impact bigger businesses gobbling up smaller businesses.
It's also going to affect hiring of these businesses as well.
Indeed. With more and more increasing automation, there's going to be less jobs available if some of these small businesses go under because of higher taxes. And what with minimum wages going up and higher taxes, pretty much they're just going to have to keep raising prices just to remain afloat. And if you raise prices, you're going to lower your customer base. And if you lower your customer base by too much, it means you can't stay afloat. And that means you're going to have to sell off your business. And this is going to probably affect quite a few of the smaller ones that might be local to your neighborhood, or they might just have a few stores in one part of your province. It can deal with all of them, and that's going to have quite the impact on everyone, not just the people that are employed by small businesses, but everyone in Canada.
Indeed. And, you know, as much as they want to have a positive impact on the middle class and they want small business to flourish, this is in effect moving business from small business to medium business and medium business up to mega corporations, which isn't what the economy needs at the end of the day. So, all right. We'll definitely be watching this one going forward because, I think we're going to be seeing a lot about this once the session resumes, among many of the other issues. It'll be interesting to see how the back and forth is covered on this. So,
indeed. We'll have to keep an eye on the House of Commons just to see what topics get brought up, because there's going to be a lot of them that are needing to be addressed at this point.
Indeed. All right. What have we got for firing line? Kind of foreshadowing House of Commons, I think.
All righty. So speaking of House of Commons, we've got a headline here that says Catherine McKenna says she is, quote, done with, quote, ridiculous Tory language on the environment. So that right there is a very interesting headline, and let's just go into it before we come back to the headline. So a few episodes ago, Shane discussed a few head-scratching policies and priorities of the Trudeau government's NAFTA negotiations with the U.S. So when negotiating with another country, it is generally in Canada's best interest that the government represents the country fairly and respects all viewpoints, especially in the House of Commons, but more importantly, what Canadians want. However, rather than trying to get a better deal on Canada's vast natural resources or the growing tech and manufacturing industries, Catherine McKenna, who is Trudeau's Minister of Environment, is still pushing for climate change action. What's more is that rather than devote time to better serving Canada at the negotiation table, McKenna is actually taking pot shots at opposition party members on Twitter and Facebook that are being classified as, quote, official government responses. So McKenna launched an angry missive at Conservative Foreign Affairs critic Aaron O'Toole on Sunday for suggesting that the environment was a mere, quote, trinket better left to the sidelines in order to protect Canada's economic well-being. However, when you actually look at O'Toole's remarks, he said that he simply wanted to make sure that NAFTA negotiations remained on the economy, creating jobs, securing market advantage, and protecting Canadian labor markets that are being undercut by cheaper Mexican labor. He mentioned that when dealing with the Republican U.S. government and Donald Trump, there is, quote, no time for the virtue signaling on gender, indigenous, and environmental issues that the government has also raised as bargaining priorities. He said, quote, "What I want to see out of Canada is less of the virtue signaling approach, where we see the centerpieces of Justin Trudeau's image building. The gender equal cabinets, the reconciliation, they're all important, but this is an economic trade agreement. I don't think anyone who's had a casual observation of the Trump administration will suggest that their priority is going to be the environment, Indigenous affairs, and other things like that," O'Toole said. So, of course, McKenna and other Liberal Party members have decried O'Toole and Andrew Scheer and the Conservatives in the media, saying that they are, quote, "undermining Canadian interests." And Gerald Butts wrote on Twitter saying that, quote, "it's still Stephen Harper's party." So that's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Catherine, you know, whenever you go to name calling and, you know, referring to people as trinkets and minimalization and effective belittling like that, it actually says a lot about argument in terms of the stance you're taking rather than approaching it with a pure fact-based argument.
Indeed. And that, it didn't actually stop there. Catherine McKenna also took to Twitter to snipe at the Conservatives with thinly veiled comments. She reduced the devastating forest fire situation in BC just to simply harp at Andrew Scheer. This is a quote from her Twitter page. Quote, "Looking out the window at a smoky Kelowna, Waterton Lakes is under fire evacuation alert. The economic impacts of climate are real, Scheer. And hashtag climate change is real, smiley face." And she also talked down to O'Toole just this evening, maybe 5 or 6 hours ago. She said, quote, "Tune in to TV question period tomorrow, where I explain to Aaron O'Toole why the environment belongs squarely in NAFTA."
You know, however, speaking on another issue with this, and the climate change is real hashtag, and to the media, she also was talking with one of her friends at CBC, Rosemary Barden, and a producer of that episode who, you know, they were just saying that they both absolutely agree with the exact same stance that McKenna was taking on this. So it's very interesting when you watch CBC and you see them come out with these kind of reports on the TV, and then you look at the Twitter feeds and you see how close these people actually are.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to note that McKenna was talking about how important good journalism is in today's society. And it's just very interesting to look at politicians' Twitters just to see how they actually talk and how they actually think. But, you know, aside from all that, when it comes to making an agreement with the United States and Donald Trump, Canada will have to work with what American interests are to ensure that Canada can still have a level playing field. I mean, Trump won't be interested in the partisan Twitter bickering of our own politicians. He's, you know, he's got his own Twitter thing to worry about, of course. And he won't really have an interest in climate change talks, you know, after he got out of the Paris Agreement a couple months ago. So to make sure that Canada gets a fair deal out of NAFTA, our government should be making sure that we get what we need first before trying for all of this other stuff, I think.
Right. And that's the thing that really needs to be underscored by the media, I think, when it comes to these NAFTA talks in general, is that, you know, we can assume that the U.S. and Mexico are going to be looking out for the best economic deal that they can get for their respective people when it comes to dealing with trade in the North American market. But if we're talking about climate change and indigenous issues relating to trade, and those on their own aren't huge chunks of the Canadian economy, we're going to, in effect, weaken our negotiating hand on this, and we're going to get a worse deal for Canadians out of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's where a lot of the divisiveness between the government and the opposition parties is, because the opposition parties don't feel like the government is taking the right stance and that they're
even
not,
the NDP
having the right approach. Yeah, the NDP don't, you know, they're probably closer in line with what the Liberals want, but they think that they aren't doing the right thing either. So it's really interesting to note how all this divisiveness is because of what the government is deciding to focus on.
All right. Well, I mean, when it comes down to Twitter bickering and that's informing NAFTA policy, that's probably when we have to worry. And you might have heard a heard a word or two in there that you didn't get, or you might not be sure exactly what it means. So what's our word of the week then?
So the word of the week this week is actually two words, and we used it in just our last story here, and it was used by Aaron O'Toole, and it is virtue signaling. So this is described as to take a conspicuous but essentially useless action, ostensibly to support a good cause, but actually to show off how much more moral you are than everybody else. So that, of course, is from our good friends at Urban Dictionary. They use that in a sentence pretty well, I think. Quote, I see George has changed his profile picture to show his support for refugees. Oh, well, has he donated money or time? Is he giving English lessons? Is he making a room available? No. He's just virtue signaling. So in a sense, virtue signaling is taking a position, say, on social media, like Facebook, just to show that you're part of the trend, but not actually do anything about it. It's basically the same thing as changing your profile to having the France flag in the backdrop there to show support for the victims of the Paris terrorist attacks, or changing it to a pride flag, or, you know, having a support your troops bumper sticker on your car, that sort of thing. It's basically taking a position just to look cool without actually doing anything about it.
Doing anything substantive.
Indeed. And I think that's why O'Toole's usage of the word actually makes sense in this scenario, because it means that they are taking the stance on climate change and the environment. But when it comes to working with the U.S. on this, they're not really going to get anywhere on this. I mean, maybe if the Democrats were in power, they might actually get somewhere with it and they'd be able to work together on this. But I think in this political climate, you have to focus on what you can actually get done. And in this case, I think getting the economics done in the trade deal, I think that's going to make much more impact.
Oh yeah, definitely. For all Canadians, because you just got to look at how tightly integrated the Canada-US economies are, and you see the benefit of NAFTA and ensuring that it continues. And we get a fair and updated deal for us. So,
indeed.
Alrighty, well, that's pretty much it for The Right Side this week. Hopefully you guys enjoyed those stories and you found them interesting and learned something along the way, and maybe share this with your friends. Here's some URLs you can give out where you can find us, where they can find us. We're at rightsidenews.ca. We're also on Twitter and Facebook at rightsidenews.ca. And if you want to subscribe on iTunes, rightsidenews.ca/iTunes or /YouTube for the YouTube version. And with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of The Right Side. Take care, everyone.
And we will have more stories for you. So make sure you tune in, and we will be back in a week.